Okay, we're going to carry. Is this on? Yeah. Okay, we're going to carry on with our panel. Committee's coordinated an exciting group of topics and speakers to talk about new treatments for Eustachian tube disorders. First couple of speakers are going to talk about methods that they can block the Eustachian tube for a couple of different reasons, while the second two speakers, or the last two speakers, will talk about methods for improving Eustachian tube function. So our first speaker is Simon Angeli from the University of Miami, and he's going to talk about Eustachian tube surgery to treat post-lateral skull-based surgery CSF leaks.
Thank you, Lauren, and I got away easy with the easiest talk. You know, closing the Eustachian tube is probably easier than making it work when you want it to work. You see, I'm local, Miami. Probably in these 8 minutes, I won't have time to tell you how wonderful it is to live and work in Miami, but we can do that over mojitos later after the talk. The obligatory disclosure slide. And first, I want to thank all my colleagues from the University of Miami who kindly helped me put this talk together. Well, CSF leaks is a well-recognized complication of lateral skull-based surgery. And its incidence appears unaffected by the surgical approach or even tumor site. We go through great lengths at surgery to prevent CSF leaks, you know, either by packing the middle ear through the facial recess approach, packing the Eustachian tube, you know, closing the dural defect, waxing air cells. But despite that, we still get from time to time some cases of CSF rhinorrhea. Fortunately, conservative measures such as bed rest, head elevation, even lumbar drains can help control, you know, most of these cases. But occasionally, we'll have a recalcitrant case that will need a re-exploration or even a repeat operation to pack a dural defect, including other traditional techniques such as blind closure of the external auditory canal and even a craniotomy, a middle fossa craniotomy for resection of the Eustachian tube. Well, the idea of closing the Eustachian tube via an endonasal approach is not new. Even our own Sujana here was one of the first ones who reported this technique. And it was proposed as a technique that a less morbidity than the traditional approaches when in selected cases. The suitable patients are those who have recalcitrant CSF rhinorrhea with non-serviceable hearing, and when a prolonged hospitalization or you want it's not desired, or whenever you want to avoid the potential complications of a wound re-exploration. Our technique includes the use of intrathecal fluorescein, which is done in the pre-anesthesia area. An hour later, the patient is taken for induction of general anesthesia. The setup is very similar to what we do for endoscopic sinus surgery. Occasionally, we need to do an endoscopic septoplasty or trim the tail of the inferior turbinate to enhance the visualization of the Eustachian tube. The Eustachian tube mucosa is then identified and denuded with curved microdebriders. You have to make sure that you debride the mucosa down to the level of the valve area. Then the Eustachian tube is obliterated with many things. We more commonly use cellular dermal grafts. And the graft is then kept in place either by a suture or by rotating a local flap or even just with packing of the nasal cavity. Let's see if we can make this video run. Right, as I said, we use the intrathecal fluorescein, which helps us confirm the diagnosis, and also we see it at the end of the procedure just to make sure that we have a good closure. This is the right side, an endoscopic view, the Eustachian tube with the fluorescein. That's the valve area where the mucosas from the anterior and posterior walls come together. So with curved instrumentation, after removing the tail of the inferior turbinate, we denude the mucosa. Use electrocautery to make sure that we get good hemostasis. There's a venous plexus in this area that tends to bleed quite a bit. We use this a cellular dermal graft to pack the Eustachian tube. And And in this case, we did more packing with gel foam and then a nasal packing with with a nasal sponge for a few days. Well, when reporting on 8 consecutive patients done over a course of 10 years, all these patients underwent surgery for removal of acoustic neuromas and developed a CSF rhinorrhea that failed conservative measures. None of these patients had serviceable hearing. The closure was successful in 6 cases. One of these successful cases needed a endoscopic revision surgery, and the two failure cases needed a more traditional approach. Estimated blood loss is not negligible, as you can see. However, most patients can go home after a few days. Some patients can go home even on the same day. This is a postoperative view where you see an absent inferior turbinate and the obliterated eustachian tube. 2 complications, 1 severe epistaxis that required endonasal cauterization, and 1 of recurring headaches. Well, in conclusion, we can claim a 75% success rate in closing CSF rhinorrhea with the endoscopic technique. This technique can be done as an outpatient or even with just a short hospital stay. Even when done in patients with serviceable hearing, the resulting conductive hearing loss can be rehabilitated with a standard hearing aid, as we're not closing the ear canal as it is done with the more traditional techniques. Some limitations, beware of patients with intracranial hypertension, which may require shunting, patients with structural changes of the tympanic membrane, and unfortunately we don't have very good customized instrumentation for the eustachian tube yet, but I know it's in the development phase now. Well, this is my part, thank you.
Simon. Our next speaker will be Brian Rotenberg, who's one of my partners at Western University in London, Ontario. Brian's a rhinologist in our department, and he's going to talk to us about the surgical treatment for patulous eustachian tubes.
Great. Thanks very much for inviting me to be in the panel. It's a pleasure to be here. Patulous eustachian tube is a rare but annoying problem. The main issue that occurs is that of otophony, of patients can hear their own voices in their head. They can also hear unusual internal physiological sounds, such as their own breathing and swallowing. And all told, this situation can actually be quite disabling for patients. It really drives them crazy. There's all sorts of etiologies that are described for this, and the most common physical finding one sees is that of TM excursions during quiet respiration. So here's a video, and we'll see if I can make this one work, of a patient breathing quietly through their nose, and they're not inhaling too much, but you can see the mobility of the eardrum as they breathe very simply through their nose. And you can imagine how that would sound for you if that was your eardrum. Here's the same patient, and we're gonna have them breathe again through their nose as I scope the nose. So this patient's awake, and we pass the scope through the eustachian tube, and you can see the incredible concavity of the defect anterolaterally. And I thought if I had a pediatric scope here, I could have passed it actually into the middle ear. So it can be quite dramatic how open the tube is. There are various management options described for this, both transotic and transnasopharyngeal techniques, all of which are very creative, and they all have had some degree of success. Meningotomy seems to be the easiest one to do, but unfortunately it does not appear to alter the otophony itself. You can plug the eustachian tube, you can put mass loading such as BluTac onto the eardrum, Premarin drops are described, Teflon or other injections, and Dr. Poe's cartilage reconstruction technique is described as well. So when Dr. Parin sent me a few of his patients to do, and I had actually had no experience with this, and I thought, what am I supposed to do with these patients? I'm not really sure. So I looked up the literature, and we, as Dr. Angeli just described, there are techniques that are used to close the eustachian tube for a CSF leak. And we thought, well, let's try this. If the other techniques haven't worked so far, let's try this technique for these patients. And so we made a modification of it. This is our endoscopic technique for patulous eustachian tube closure. We do a pre-op temporal bone CT primarily to rule out carotid artery dehiscence. Patients intubated via an oral airway and prep for endoscopic sinus surgery. A small amount of periambolical fat is retrieved, and then minced up to maximize blood supply to the adipocytes. Here's a view through the endoscope. We have an illustration on the right and the patient's nose on the left. You can see injection into the torus tuberus for hemostasis, suction cautery of the valve area, and this is done for two reasons. One is to induce scarring, and the other is actually to make a little scaffold for the fat to sit on. Fat is then placed through the nose and used to pack off the eustachian tube. And then this is the hard part of the case, is we suture ligate it closed as well using a specially designed endoscopic suture placer. Here's a short video of that technique actually taking place. So the injection goes in with this long spinal needle. We then use the suction cautery, as mentioned earlier, to obliterate the lumen of the eustachian tube. That's a pack on the nose on the contralateral side. There is an angled view of the scope that you can see the scaffolding. The fat is now placed through the nose and into the eustachian tube itself and packed deeply with various instruments. That's a caudal elevator, or you can use a ball probe to pack it as well. And then we use a Vicryl TF curved needle to suture ligate the eustachian tube closed. I've actually switched nowadays to a more permanent needle so the sutures don't come undone in these patients. And we use a little knot pusher to push the knot down and tie it off. This is published in Laryngoscope with my co-authors. So here's our results. In 2009, we've done 15 patients in 21 years, and using our otophony scale, adapted from Dr. Poe's paper, we found there's an overall clinical improvement in 18 of 21 years. This is not to say they were cured, mind you, but these patients are all improved clinically and statistically as well. Perhaps equally importantly, there's been no adverse impact on hearing via pre- and post-op audiogram. Now, there were some challenges with this, in that several patients unfortunately had no improvement despite multiple attempts at doing this. So again, back to the literature, and actually we had the courtesy of speaking with Dennis himself on the phone several times to give me a hand with some of these unusual and challenging cases. And we thought, how else can we improve these patients? And so we thought of using radius injections and a stent placement, or actually probably a shim placement is the more correct technique. Radius is calcium hydroxyapatite microspheres that are used to entrain water and expand tissue, and they dissolve over time and are replaced by collagen. These can be injected into the ear. And also we can place this shim, which is actually a simple suction cannula filled with melted bone wax that acts as a plug to baffle the sound that enters the eustachian tube. So here's a short video of the injection and of the stent placement. Here's a patient who already had their tube closed, and it looks like it'd be incredibly closed, yet they still had the otophony. So using a wide-gauge bent spinal needle, the hydroxyapatite microspheres are injected, and it's quite simple to do, just right through the nose directly, suction away the excess, and you can put more in as you need to. The sucker goes in, it sucks away very easily, you can put more in as needed. Here's the suction catheter with bone wax inside of it. This is placed endoscopically through the nose, and then an angle instrument is used to manually push the plug up into the eustachian tube and actually until it actually wedges at the bony isthmus. And you can actually feel the wedge going in there, and there's the final view of it. So it just sits there, no problems. Now, I've had one or two of those actually come out over time, either due to vigorous sneezing or coughing, and it was amazing that patients really felt considerably better as soon as the tube was placed, and then as soon as it came out, their otophony resumed. So I thought, that's too bad. And we started actually suturing these into place using a suture ligation type technique. So here's one view of that, here's a second one. These ones have never yet come out on me. So six shims were placed over 2 years. Over the beginning, they had to adapt because they felt a bit of pressure at the back of their head and the back of their ear, but there was sustained, and I must say, considerable improvement in the otophony as well. No extrusions, no need for removal, and no ear effusion despite no ear tube being there, which I thought was quite remarkable. We also, of course, have to have complications as a surgeon, and so there was one patient who had a severe complication, unexpectedly developed total eustachian tube scarring and then repeated otitis media with effusion. And we would put an ear tube in that we would suction the fluid out, and her fluid was unusually thick that it would seem to plug off the actual ear tube over and over again. So she had to go for several ORs, one after another. The situation was just not viable for her, and so we felt that she needed a formal reconstruction. So Laura and I did this case together. What we actually did was used a balloon sinuplasty Reliva lumicentry cable passed through the tympanic membrane into the eustachian tube, and then we actually looked at it under the endoscope to find where it was in the nose and pulled it through the nose. So it sounds a bit complex, but it worked very well, and here is what we did. So here's the endoscopic view, and you can see the light that's behind the wall of scar tissue. Without that light, we couldn't see a thing. This is a curved scalpel blade we're using to make an incision to try and find the cable, which we now found, unable to grab it. And once we pulled it out a little bit, you could see this huge amount of mucus that was trapped behind there, causing her pressure and her headaches. suctioning all that out. And then here's a little suction tube going inside to make sure we formally widen the opening. I'm not sure why the video stopped there. And actually here we are pulling it out. So that's pulling through the ear, through the nose. And we threaded a catheter up through that. I don't have that on video, unfortunately, and placed it in like a stent. And that was about 2 years ago, and she's doing great to this day.
And the catheter is still there?
Catheter is still there, yes. So overall, we have a novel technique of tubal ligation being demonstrated to lead to otophany improvement in the majority of patients. If necessary, Radiesse can be used to augment this. And shim placement is a little bit tougher, especially if you're using a securing suture. But I must say, in my experience, it's given the best overall results. And what I like about it is that if it's not working and the patient has problems, that is reversible very easily. It's a bit of a short follow-up time. Are there improvements sustained for the long term? And as of yet, there is no validated outcome tool for patrocystation tube. So in conclusion, endoscopically, we can use our techniques to improve patrocyst overall functioning. There are multiple options, including ligation, injection, and shim placement. But as of yet, there are some technical issues that remain to be solved. Thank you very much.
Great talk, Brian. Our next speaker will be Sujana Chandrasekhar. She's going to talk to us about her novel treatment using surfactants to treat eustachian tube dysfunction. Sujana is from Mount Sinai Medical School in New York.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you to the Trilogic Society for allowing me to present. The last time I presented some of this data at the Trilogic was when I presented my thesis in Nashville, Tennessee. So it's a couple of years later. I did all the animal research that you're going to see without any interest in the company. And then when I saw that this worked and my kids had to go to college, I decided to invest in this company. And I've lost quite a bit of money so far. But I do own interest in this company. I also consult to a couple of companies, cochlear implant companies. So we all know what a bear it is when the eustachian tube does not open. We've heard about it not closing, but most of us more often will treat patients in whom the eustachian tube doesn't open well. Valsalva maneuver and other mechanical maneuvers don't really work or very difficult, and in fact, studies show that about 30% of people can't do Valsalva effectively. The nasal steroid sprays that we use get to the nose, but don't get all the way back to the eustachian tube, not even the latest and greatest that you guys have been detailed about in your offices. They don't quite make it to the eustachian tube. We know that that's true because none of them have an indication for eustachian tube dysfunction from the FDA. So I'm going to talk about a product that we've called Otodyne, and it's a dry metered dose inhaler intranasal steroid spray. Surfactant spray. And surfactant is so named because it's a surface active agent. This happens to have completely synthetic dipalmitoyl phosphatidylcholine and cholesterol palmitate. It's not made from animal products. It's a completely synthetic material. It has no proteins in it. There you go. It has hydrophilic ends and hydrophobic tails. And these are towards the lumen, and these are away from the lumen. So essentially, when it hits a mucosal surface, it reorients itself and therefore pulls the apposed mucosal surfaces apart from each other. It's delivered as a dry aerosol powder that you can see here. When it's delivered as comes out as a clump, and as soon as it hits a wet surface, it turns into a shard-like shape that sort of travels on its own without requiring ciliary action to get to where it needs to go. So for example, if this table was wet and I put some surfactant over here, it would reach over where Dennis is sitting in about 5 or 10 minutes because of the change in shape. How does this stuff work? Well, we all know that the pain from otitis media is caused by pressure from a blocked eustachian tube, and then fluid builds up in the middle ear space. And what happens is that the powder enters, turns into these lipid crystal shards, goes to the eustachian tube, de-sticks the eustachian tube, and lets the fluid drain. And the patient is, lo and behold, very happy and is going out dancing. But when I was a resident, the fashion for a short while, a very short while, was when children came into the ER with acute otitis media to Bellevue, we were remanded that we had to papoose this kid down and do a meningotomy. Thank God we didn't have access to a laser. I don't know what we'd have done to these kids. But we were supposed to do a meningotomy to relieve the pain. Because once you relieve the pain and the pressure, the body will heal itself. And sometimes we got one meningotomy done and we never got the second side done in these kids. But this is the same concept. If you relieve that pressure, you'll allow some air in and you'll allow the ear to heal itself. So, you know, when you young folks in here work towards your trilogic thesis, I remember having a big piece of paper on my office wall and every experiment that I wanted in my thesis in there so that I would have 10 experiments ready and I could present my thesis. So this was the first one that I did. And what we did was I had a very nice postdoc in the lab with me, and he came up with this ability to put a needle into the middle ear space of gerbils and mice. So they were anesthetized. They were obviously alive. The needle entered the middle ear space. The tympanic membrane stayed secure. We were able to infuse pressure in, and then as the pressure raised, the pressure in the middle ear was rising, and then when the pressure dropped, we knew that the eustachian tube had to open because that's the only way to relieve the pressure. So we measured something called passive opening pressure in these animals. Repeated measures were able to be done, and the animals did not need to be sacrificed. So when we looked at that, we looked at gerbils and mice, and we saw that we were able to, after giving the surfactant spray in the nose, we were able to reduce the passive opening pressure from a baseline of, here in a gerbil, 48 millimeters of mercury to 28 millimeters of mercury consistently, a significant reduction in the amount of pressure needed to open the eustachian tube. I tested this with just the propellant because I wondered if I was just pushing propellant back and opening the eustachian tube, and that didn't work, which is up there. And then I tested it with the surfactant, and it worked. So based on that, we gave a bunch of gerbils Klebsiella pneumonia, lipopolysaccharide, otitis media with effusion, and we measured them by otomicroscopy and by tympanometry for 30 days. And we treated them either with nothing, which is the black control. The dull gray is placebo, which is just the propellant. The duller gray is the surfactant with phenylephrine. And then the blue is surfactant alone, and the pink is surfactant with steroid. And so what you can see is that the control and the other two, the placebo and the phenylephrine groups, took 16 days to resolve their effusion. When we gave surfactant alone, that took 10 days. And when we gave surfactant with steroid, that took 8 days. And we continued to examine the animals for the entire 30-day period, and none of them re-accumulated an effusion. So that was a significant finding. So then we thought, oh, that's kind of nice. What happens? Well, one first thing that happened is I decided that my lab people had done the experiment wrong, so I repeated the whole thing because that was kind of remarkable. And then we looked at once versus twice daily. And so what we found was, again, it takes about 16 days if you just give an effusion for the animal to resolve the effusion. We found that actually phenylephrine given twice a day makes things a little bit worse, but much more importantly, surfactant alone took 10 days. Surfactant alone twice a day took 8 days. Surfactant with steroid once a day took 8 days. And surfactant with steroid twice a day took 6 days, which is a statistically significant finding. So I presented that, and then Romeo Lim asked me, why don't I just look at acute otitis media? So I did. So we did this experiment up in Boston, in the laboratory of somebody who does a lot of vaccine work. He makes does a lot of vaccine testing in animals, and he really didn't believe it was not Dennis, because Dennis believes anything I tell him. But it was someone else who didn't believe that this stuff worked. And we gave these chinchillas acute otitis media with Haemophilus influenza. We chose chinchillas because they have a big bulla, they have a big mastoid. You can actually take the cap off the bulla, look, take some cultures, take some pictures, put everything back together, and send them back to animal care. What we found out at the course of the study is that chinchillas are, in fact, much more prone to labyrinthitis from otitis media than we thought. And the ethical use of animals is that if they develop labyrinthitis and they twirl and they don't eat for 24 hours, they are euthanized. But if they stop twirling and they start eating again, they can proceed with the experiment. So what we found was we had 39 animals. These all had very bad infections, very bad H flu AOM. At day 12 of the study, 50% of the surfactant animals had normal or near normal tympanometry versus only 20% of the placebo animals. The cultures were positive in only 15% at day 27 of the treated animals versus 70% of the non-treated animals. We had three animals in the treatment group who developed labyrinthitis. One actually stopped twirling and continued with the study, but two had to be euthanized. We lost 75% of the placebo animals to labyrinthitis. The middle ear was considered dry on direct visual inspection in 62% of the animals at day 27 versus only 8% of the control. And the same numbers. There was pus in the middle ear and 5% at day 27 of the treated animals and 60% of the control. And so this is what the middle ear of a chinchilla looks like. So we want it to look like this with a nice single ossicle and a beautiful, nice, normal middle ear space. They all started like this with pus. This we called moist and that we called dry. And you can see that the infection was equally bad in all the animals until day 12 when there was a diversion and the surfactant animals got better and no antibiotics were given during any portion of this. So unfortunately humans are neither mice, gerbils, nor chinchilla. But I think that there is a significant potential role for the use of intranasal surfactant as a treatment for eustachian tube dysfunction. I will tell you that I've personally used it on flights back from meetings that where the air pressure in the plane is giving me ear pain, and it works really well. So for airplane ear, for diver's ear. What FDA has opened the investigational new device and drug application for us is as a treatment for acute otitis media. So what we have to do, and I think as an otologist that all those ears that I'm chasing with my beautiful prostheses and my beautiful auriculoplasty that just keep falling down again, I'd love to see if giving some surfactant and making the eustachian tube work better helps that, but that's a little bit of a pipe dream. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to do phase one safety, and then if that's proven safe by FDA standards, which I think it will be because these are agents that are currently used in Similac, these are commonly used agents, then we're going to be able to do efficacy trials in children as young as 6 months with acute otitis media. And just, I'm going to go over for one more 30 seconds.
Okay.
This is a 50-year-old colleague of mine who developed rhinitis and unilateral eustachian tube dysfunction, serous otitis media symptoms. And at time zero, this is his left eustachian tube. You can see that the whole thing is red and boggy. There's wet mucosa. There's no air bubbles coming out of this eustachian tube. At five, we gave the surfactant at that time. At 5 minutes, his nose felt better, but the eustachian tube felt about the same, and the ear felt about the same. At 10 minutes, the nasal breathing was much better, and you can see that the eustachian tube now opens, especially when he was able to do sustained yawns to really try to pop it open, which he had not been able to do previously. At 15 minutes, he said, "That's it. My ear is great. I'm feeling great." You can see that there's an air bubble sitting here. The valve opened nicely with forced yawns and with the movements that we normally ask them to do. And then at 20 minutes, it was nice and normal with a lot of air bubbles. So I'm hoping that that continues to happen, and hopefully I'll be able to stand up another 10 years from now maybe and tell you guys something else. Thank you.
Thanks, and Jonah, that's great stuff. We saved the best for last. Dennis Poe is the reigning champ of treatment of eustachian tube disorders. And Dennis is from Boston Children's Hospital at Harvard, and he's going to talk to us about balloon tuboplasty.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for having me on this panel. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real privilege to be here, especially with this distinguished panel. Not a champ at all. I've got more failures than anybody else, so just been doing it longer. So everything I'm going to tell you here may be rendered passé if Sujana's treatments work. But in the meantime, this is what we're doing. Just quickly, disclaimers, although I am a consultant for the Acclarent Corporation, I accept no personal compensation for any of that work and or any personal benefit. We are going to be talking about the off-label use of balloon sinuplasty equipment for the eustachian tube. So the multiple endoscopic studies have shown that in most cases, otitis media conditions are associated with problems in the cartilaginous portion and not in the bony cartilaginous isthmus, the narrowest diameter portion of the eustachian tube, which actually can be quite patent even during acute effusions. So with that in mind, we've evolved a concept that really what's going on is a problem with the valve area, the portion of the cartilaginous eustachian tube in which the mucosal surfaces contact each other. So this is what we see with an endoscopic view. This is a right eustachian tube. Adenoid would be here. This is the posterior cushion. And we see this nice S-shaped curve to the valve. So that's formed in part by the bulk of the tensor veli palatini muscle, the subcutaneous submucosa, and the lateral cartilaginous lamina in this closed position. And here you see it in the dilated position with the medial cartilaginous lamina or posterior cushion medially rotated, and then the tensor muscle has dilated the tube open. And this is what we see as a consistent pattern in normals for opening the eustachian tube. So we've tried to carefully study what are the most common findings that we see in the dysfunctional, non-dilating eustachian tube. And at least in our study, it's mucosal inflammation has been the most common consistent finding. And so the question is, well, where is that coming from? And it's all the usual suspects. If you go to any of the rhinology meetings, allergies, rhinosinusitis, adenoid hypertrophy, reflux, et cetera, and all the other miscellaneous things that can cause that. This is some of our own work, as yet unpublished, of biofilms being seen on this confocal microscopy. These green dots are live bacteria in the eustachian tube orifice. No surprise, we know that they exist in the middle ear and in the adenoids, so it's no surprise to find them here in the eustachian tube as well. So we've tried to study what is the behavior of this inflammation and trying to get a handle on where is it coming from and how can that be treated. This is some of that work. These are biopsies taken from the specimen that you're seeing right there. And this is a common finding where you see this cobblestoning hypertrophied mucosa. This has previously been described as the tonsil of Gerlich. It is really adenoid tissue in the posterior cushion. What has not been described previously is that these lymphoid follicles and lymphoid hyperplasia can migrate right down the eustachian tube lumen as well, as you can see here. And this seems to be a very common finding. So again, where is this inflammation coming from? Remains unproven. So you all know how to treat that. We do the best we can. We treat allergies, reflux, chronic rhinosinusitis as best we can. When all of those things fail, we place tympanostomy tubes. So what about the patients who they get the tube, falls out, and the problem is still there? These are the patients in whom we've tried to look at surgical treatments for the eustachian tubes. We've been doing this many years now. Started out with lasers, we've done microdebriders, other techniques to try and widen it. And the indications for these types of tuboplasty procedures have been persistent effusion or non-adherent atelectasis, not retraction pockets as you see here, type B or C tympanograms in nearly all of the patients, with the exception being the people who only have trouble with flights or scuba diving. They are all symptomatic. They have conductive hearing losses because of this, except for the scuba divers. Pain or blockage in their ear with pressure changes. And they get better with tympanostomy tubes. This is not oral, A-U-R, oral fullness with an otherwise normal ear and no barometric complaints. So I was moderately pleased with laser results and microdebrider results, but wanted to do better. Balloons have come along, but I didn't think that they would be adequate. So we wanted to start looking at balloons critically. And this study was done to show why they, I couldn't think of any real reason why they should work. And in fact, it did have some benefits. So here we see a cross-section of a Eustachian tube longitudinally. This is the nasopharyngeal orifice at the zero mark. It narrows down here to the bony cartilaginous junction, just about at the 24 millimeter mark. And here's the middle ear over here. So this is the bony portion. And we put the balloons in here. Sinuplasty balloons, and we found a very significant increase in cross-sectional diameter of the Eustachian tubes, not so much persisting here at the orifice where the cartilage is very flexible, just goes back to normal. We didn't see any fractures of the cartilage. And it's not dilating very much here where it's very constricted at the bony portion. So, but it dilated very nicely in the middle portion of the cartilaginous tube, which is just where the valve occurs. So that was very interesting, compelling enough that we had to move this to the clinical practice. And so this is what you see in a cadaver dissection here. This is the tubal orifice. This is the medial cartilaginous lamina that lies within the posterior cushion. Here's the internal carotid artery, which we know comes in a very close approximation with the Eustachian tube as it enters the skull base. The balloon sits right here, pretty much in the mid portion of the cartilaginous Eustachian tube, and then we inflate it. We have a mucosal rating scale, which is in the process of being validated, but you know, briefly it goes from normal, grade 1, to mild, moderate inflammation, and severe inflammation, completely unable to dilate. So this is what it looks like. This is a left side with a 45-degree endoscope in the left nostril. And this is the posterior cushion. I'm using this curved 70-degree guide catheter being guided through the nasal cavity now. This is the inferior turbinate on this left side. So following that catheter along with the 45-degree endoscope. So here's the tubal orifice. We'll introduce this into the lumen. There's the balloon catheter starting to protrude. Now you've got to get past that bulge of the posterior cushion. So there's a little bit of medial direction initially that you have to take to get past that. If you don't do that, you can lacerate the mucosa and get a false passage. The balloon's fully inserted now. This yellow mark is at the 31 millimeter from the tip, so that should not be inside the lumen. The balloon gets inflated. You can see there was a little bit of mucus trapped in the lumen there. We inflate it to 12 atmospheres for 2 minutes, deflate, pull the balloon out so it doesn't scrape the mucosa, and you usually see a little trickle like this of some blood, as probably from some mucosal tears with the balloon. So I started doing this project when I was on a research leave in Finland. So this is the ongoing work of my colleagues there. Juha Silvola was the primary surgeon on these people. I participated in most of these cases to begin with, and then he continued. And so it's our longest running series, 4.5 years, 80 cases. It's actually well over 100 now. 42 of these balloon Eustachian tubeplasties with no other concomitant procedures. These are mostly adults. There were a couple under 18. And no complications to date. So what we're seeing is here in the blue are the pre-op results, just one type A there. The rest are type B and C tympanograms, or they've still got a tube or a perforation in place. Post-operatively, a significant improvement in the tympanograms with a majority here of type A, some Cs, no Bs, and some of the perforations hadn't closed. The other significant improvement was in the mucosal inflammation scores, whereas previously there was a few that were normal, but most being mild to severe. And very significant improvement, post-op results here, most are normal now, and very few severes. Also, significant amount of improvement in the ability to do a Valsalva. So this big change is a big decrease in inflammation. Now, it's really been a lot of question, well, why would that be? Here's what it looks like. This is pre-op. Here's a closed resting eustachian tube versus open dilating attempt. We see the closed position here. You don't have a, you've got some edema here. It's a little swollen. You don't see very deeply into the valve, particularly on a dilation attempt. But here, afterwards, we see a much rounder view into the tubal lumen. There's decreased edema here, much less inflammation, and a much deeper view into the valve in this post-dilation view. Less inflammation, and the question is why. So we've been looking at that critically. So now I've been, this is to be published hopefully soon, but we're taking biopsies before and after the dilation. So here is before the dilation, and we're seeing what you saw before, lymphocytic infiltrate, follicles, thickened mucosa, even with some lymphocytic infiltrate into the epithelium, loss of cilia. And then afterwards, we see that a lot of the epithelium has just been stripped off, and you don't really appreciate that clinically. It's been stripped even down to the basal layer, but the mucosa, basal layer is still preserved, and the lymphocytic infiltrate and the follicles are just squashed selectively. The submucosal tissues, the glands, appear to be intact, pristine. So it seems to be specifically targeting the surface and submucosa. 6 weeks later, this is still very preliminary data, but here's lymphocytic infiltrates preoperatively in very thick epithelium. Postoperatively, much thinner submucosa, and these lymphocytic infiltrates and follicles have been replaced with scar tissue in a much thinner layer. So there's reduced inflammation, restoration of the pseudocolumnar epithelia and cilia. Similar results are being seen elsewhere. This is the Germans. They started doing balloon dilations at just about the same time using a 3-millimeter balloon. 10 atmospheres, 2 to 3 dilations they'll do at a time. And they use this fiber endoscope approach. Holger Sudoff, Professor Sudoff, presented last year 600 cases of ages, including some children, 86% improvement in eustachian tube function. Some complications, air emphysema, probably from a false passage. Tinnitus, unsure of why, and one case of epistaxis. At the military hospital in Germany, they presented 200 children. Now, they only did glue ears. They did not do recurrent acute otitis media, and I think that's prudent. These are patients who really just had glue ears. They did this instead of tympanostomy tubes. We don't know what the effects of this would be in young children. It may be a different behavior, a different pattern of problems in young children. They may be refluxing pathogens, and if you dilate them, they may reflux more. So I would emphasize caution in thinking about pediatrics because we don't know all the full mechanisms at play there. But still, 75-80% of these children did not need tubes. McCool and Anand-Vijay Anand's results, 22 adults, 35 procedures, significant improvements in a similar number of patients. They actually had fairly stellar results in this early group with preoperative tympanograms becoming normal in all but one of their cases and their retraction improving in all of their cases that they looked at. They developed a eustachian tube dysfunction questionnaire score and validated that, and their scores improved postoperatively with or without concomitant procedures. There was no statistical difference, and SNOT 22 scores improved as well. So, in conclusion, the early results and now some medium term results out to 4.5 years are showing that the balloon eustachian tubuloplasty has some significant benefit. It's probably having some effectiveness by stripping off irreversibly diseased mucosa, whether that's containing biofilm or other inflammatory changes, we don't know. And it's apparently targeting the lymphocytic infiltrates and follicles in the submucosa. So I'm starting to think of this as perhaps the eustachian tube is another accessory sinus, and we're having a specific effect on reducing the inflammation in there. I'm thinking of it in the same way that you would think about doing an adenoidectomy, and that reduced inflammatory burden may be benefiting these patients. A great deal of basic science still needs to be done to look into all of this, why this may be working, and what is the pathophysiology of eustachian tube dysfunction and resultant otitis media with effusion. But this is giving us a lot of potential benefit of directions to look at. So indications, again, irreversible mucosal disease, failure of tympanostomy tubes. Studies are clearly needed, basic science, further studies in children, and very carefully done, and long-term controlled studies, which we're working on. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, as usual, Dennis. We're kind of out of time. Maybe if we have one or two burning questions from the audience, you can step to the microphone, please, Fred.
Fred Talisi, Miami. Dennis, great work over a long period of time. Have you done any patients that have difficulty clearing in pressure-related occupations or activities? So pilots or scuba divers or things like that, and what were the outcomes?
Come up here.
So I haven't presented those results, but pilots and scuba divers are among our best patients to treat. They appear to have a less inflammatory burden, so they're very amenable to improvement with this technique. They're among my favorite group to treat now. I would also mention caution. Although I've not had patchless eustachian tube, I know some other groups who have had some patchless eustachian tubes. I know of three cases of persistent patchless tubes. So if you take someone with no visible inflammatory problems, you'll want to be careful. Maybe not as big a balloon, maybe not as much pressure.
I have one question for you too, Dennis. Do we need to worry about the carotid artery?
So I've been worrying about the carotid artery since I embarked on this, and that was one of the very first things we did was those cadaver dissections to try to learn what the variability of that was. There can be a lot of variability in the skull base and also in the nasopharyngeal region. Fortunately, unless you have a congenital anomaly, syndromic condition, we've never seen carotid arteries coming that close to the eustachian tube. So as long as we're staying inside the cartilaginous eustachian tube, I'm quite comfortable that we're in a safe area from there.
Any other questions? Please come to the microphone.
Kevin Brown, New York. Dennis, I have a question for you. With the balloon sinuplasty, people have been using the lighted guide wire to verify position. And I know Vijay has done it, but I didn't see it in your presentation. Do you find it useful to use the lighted guide wire to confirm that you're in the eustachian tube and haven't created a false passage by looking for the light in the middle ear?
So it's a very important question you bring up. I don't use a guide wire for a couple of reasons. One, if you have an angled endoscope, you can look right at the lumen, so you can just directly put the balloon catheter into the lumen. And as long as it's sliding easily, you're not forcing it, I found no need to use a guide wire. The second issue with the guide wire is it too easily gets up into the middle ear, so I'd be concerned that somebody would bump into an important thing up there, ossicles, et cetera. A further issue is if you do use a guide wire, you've got to remember to take it out, because if you blow up the balloon with an occluded lumen in that catheter, you could get an overpressure injury to the middle ear. So several reasons why I prefer not to use a guide wire. I think in the very early work, people like Dr. Anand were interested in putting up the guide wire, looking in the ear, making sure they could see a red glow. But we've really found as long as you respect the distance, look at that yellow mark, for instance, you're making sure you're not going in too deeply, it's passing easily, and you're doing it with an angled endoscope, you can be very confident you're in the cartilaginous tube. Thank you.
I think we'll wrap it up. Thanks, everybody, and enjoy the rest of the meeting.
Thanks, guys. That was fantastic. That was just a great panel. Nice job.
Thank you so much. I
really appreciate you. I'm glad they let you come in. You didn't have to wear the mustache.